Do you want to be more organized and less stressed in 2019? I mean, obviously. So you should check out Harvest. Harvest makes super helpful software for planning projects, tracking time, sending invoices, and more. It's great for freelancers or consultants and scales up for large teams of all kinds. Check it out today at getharvest.com/strongfeelings to get 50% off your first month. That's getharvest.com/strongfeelings.
I've been deprogrammed. I know who I am. Control has been lifted. It's all in my hands. I'll close my eyes.
Hey everyone, I'm Sarah.
And I'm Cattell.
And this is Strong Feelings, a podcast about work, friendship, and feminism, and what happens when you bring them all together. And Cattell, this is our season premiere.
Oh my gosh, I know. I'm so psyched that we're kicking off this year as Strong Feelings. And I know this sounds funny, but can we say hi to our listeners?
Yeah. Hey, hi everyone. So welcome back. And yes, you are in the right place. This used to be Know You Go. If you missed that memo, we talk about it in our December finale. So definitely go back and check that out.
Yes. And if you're new here, hi, and thank you for listening. I'm Cattell Adu. I'm the CEO of an independent book publishing company called A Book Apart. I might be a little bit of an oversharer, and even though I'm the boss in a lot of areas of my life, I get completely and utterly stuck in a lot of other places. So I try to talk through that sometimes, and because I know it helps me, and I hope it helps other folks who might be listening.
And I'm Sarah Wachter-Betcher. I run a little consulting company called Rare Union, and I've written a couple books. One of them was actually for Cattell's company. And then the most recent one is called Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech, which makes me a lot of friends at parties. And that's actually one of the things I feel like I'm still figuring out, which is, you know, what happens to your consulting business when you get super honest and kind of political in a book like that or in a podcast like this? Will people still want to work with you? And by you, I mean me. So I'll let you all know when I figure that out.
Yeah, keep us posted. Okay, so it's January, new year, new name, fresh start. So what are we doing today?
Well, we have one of my favorite writers on the show, Heather Havrileski.
Yes.
She is a cultural critic, and she's also known as Ask Polly, the advice columnist for New York Magazine's The Cut. And did I ever tell you how I started reading her work?
No.
Okay. So it was maybe 2003, 2004. So like we have to go way back to Baby Sarah.
Yes. I love Baby Sarah.
Okay. So I was in college and I worked the swing shift at a credit union doing customer service. Thank you for choosing Pentagon Federal Credit Union. This is Sarah. How may I help you? And I had this coworker, Noelle, who was just like a little bit older than me and a lot cooler than I was. Like, I was always trying to do a really good job at work, and she was very much like, this place is not worth all of me. I am just going to coast on by and get on with my life.
Yeah.
Which she was probably right about. So anyway, one night she sent me this link to something called Rabbit Blog, and that was Heather Havrileski's blog.
Nice.
So I remember that Heather also seemed way cooler than me. She had that kind of like detached Gen X sort of droll, funny way about her. And I remember I read all of the archives of her blog between calls. And then I realized she had been a writer at suck.com before that, which was like the first place you could find satire on the internet, like in the late 90s. And so I started reading her work there. So yeah, I was a longtime fan. And it was kind of a joy after I lost track of her for a few years in there to discover her again writing Ask Polly, which is such a strong recommend to me. I love that advice column if you haven't read it before. But she's also been a cultural critic for a long time. So she writes about pop culture and books and modern American life for, you know, New York Times Magazine. And she used to write for Salon. And so now, just a couple months ago, she had a new book come out and it's called What If This Were Enough?
Oh, that is such a good question.
I know, right? Yeah. I have been rolling that question over and over in my head since I read the book. And so I was really excited to interview her, especially here at the start of a new year and a new season. Like, I don't really do resolutions. No judgment if that's something that works for you. But I find that resolutions tend to make me feel like I'm like giving myself a jail sentence of some sort, right? Like, it feels like punitive.
Mm.
Like I've done something wrong and now I need to like
correct.
Yeah. And not every resolution feels that way, but that's kind of what I have attached to them. What I do like, though, at the new year is that it is this kind of moment of transition, and that helps me take a pause, reflect on things, and oftentimes reprioritize. And, you know, especially I tend to have a lot of different stuff going on at the same time. So taking a moment to prioritize those things and think about them differently is helpful. So what if this were enough is a question that I've been asking myself, and, you know, in a lot of different ways, right? So what if I have enough already? What if I'm doing enough already? What if I am enough already?
Oh, gosh. I mean, this is something I struggle with a lot. You know, I run a company and I still feel like an imposter. Like, I am the boss and I'm still like, should I be the boss? Should I be in charge? Like, am I the right person? And I really want to be open about feeling that way. But it's hard because I want to admit that I feel like an imposter, but I don't want anyone to know that I'm an imposter.
Yeah, I have felt that way too. And, you know, sometimes I'm thinking like, okay, I've created a successful career for myself. I've done good work. I've accomplished lots of things that mattered to me. There's still this little part of me, this little voice that's wondering like, when are they all going to find out I'm a fraud? Or, you know, like, when's it all going to come crumbling down on me and I'm going to have to go back and work at that call center again?
You never know. So I don't think I ever told you this before, but actually I felt so much like this the first time I met you.
Wait, really? When?
Yeah. So this was 3 years before I actually got to know you. It was right after I joined A Book Apart as the managing director, and you were still the editor in chief at A List Apart.
Okay. Yeah. So for anybody who's outside of that particular bubble, A List Apart is like a sister publication for people who work in tech and design. And yeah, I edited there for several years.
Yeah. So I've talked a little bit about this on the show before, but I felt really alone when I started there and I was, you know, figuring a lot of stuff out solo and kind of making it up as I went along, like creating a budget and a P&L for the whole business and building out a lot of the operational framework, which was like creating pre-press checklist. So we knew exactly what to expect when we were dealing with printers and, you know, the warehouse. And I know I've mentioned this before, but I'd never worked on book publishing before. So that was fun and exciting. And I was really comfortable doing editorial work and managing a publishing process. But I'd come from a very different flavor of that at National Geographic. And I was sort of like, great, this is awesome. A new job, learn a whole new thing. So I was figuring out a bunch of stuff, and our book pitch review process was actually something I'd really wanted to put just more structure around, because we would have great discussions around proposals that would come in, but we didn't really have any criteria that we were weighing like pros and cons against. And I went looking for some advice, and I thought I'd try reaching out to you and asking you what your experience had been, because you'd not only been, you know, managing A List Apart, but you'd written a book, so you'd been through like a whole different part of the process. And I was so nervous. I was kind of a big fan of you and your work, and you'd written that book. You just got shit done at A List Apart, and then I was late for the call we had set up. I remember feeling so inadequate before I'd even met you.
Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, I will tell you this. I remember us having that call. I don't remember you being late. Like, that is lost to time. I have no recollection of that because it wasn't a big deal to me. And also, I had no idea that you could possibly feel that way.
Well, good. That makes me feel a little better. But so we got on the call, and after I think I did a lot of apologizing, I asked you all these questions, and you were so generous with your time and, you know, just very kind, and you shared a lot with me, and I felt very reassured.
Well, what's funny about that meeting is that I actually remember back at that time being a little bit jealous of you.
What?
Yeah. Okay. So I was running this magazine as a side project, and it was meant to be a side project. I was being paid a stipend to do it, and I do think I did a good job with it. It was a pretty popular magazine, and I was able to sort of like grow the budget that it had and, you know, pay people better and publish more and all of that. But I felt like it was such a little insignificant thing compared to what you were doing, because I was like, oh, you're running a publishing house that has like real products, like real money, right? Like, you sell things for dollars and then people buy them and want them and read them. And that's just like such a different kind of setup. And so in my mind, you were running this real legit business, and therefore you must be more legit than I was.
Oh my gosh. That I just can't imagine both of us thinking these things now. And I mean, it took time for us to get to know each other, but then we ended up obviously being friends, but I don't know, just also learning we could really trust each other. It turned out, I think that those fears and worries that I were having were totally not based in reality. And I was letting them cloud my thinking and just sort of like how I was going into that situation.
Same. And I think for me, part of the problem was that I feel like at that time I was still in a place where I felt like I needed to establish myself. Like, I didn't necessarily feel like I was stable in my credibility or in my profile. So I think that I was often going into situations, maybe I don't know that I could have seen this at the time, but I was going into situations feeling like I needed to look at how I was doing in relation to others and whether I was doing enough, getting enough opportunities, established enough, et cetera. And it put me into this place where, you know, I was feeling like a fundamental sense of scarcity. And I think that scarcity concept is something that I've heard, you know, kind of around recently. And it's helpful to think about like, oh, I was looking at it from the perspective of like, okay, there's only room for so many people to have success or to get the things that they want. And so I need to like jockey for position amongst them. And it's not that I felt directly competitive with you. Like, I did not actually want your job.
Right.
But it was that I was coming at it from this place of comparison. Like, is what I'm doing as valuable or as big or as real or whatever as this other person? And like, when you do that, what I realize now, of course, is you can't really see the other person because you're not there to see them. You're always there like comparing them to yourself. And if I can't really see you and come to the conversation with your needs really in mind, it's like very hard to get to know somebody and then to trust them.
Yeah, totally. And I do want to say that I feel very seen by you. One of the many reasons I love you is that you always look for ways to lift me up, which is just so incredibly, you know, kind and nurturing, I think, in our friendship. Like, you make a point of introducing me to people as the CEO of a company.
I do love to do that. It makes me happy. Because I think that it honestly, it depends on the scenarios. Like, I don't try to do that in every social setting. But there are times when I see people notably shift the way that they are reacting to you because I've said that. And I mean, that's kind of bullshit in some ways that that happens. But I think, you know, it's so easy to condescend to women. And that gives a way to make sure that that doesn't happen as much. Anyway, I also really like to do that because I guess I feel like telling people how fucking great my friends are is really fun. Like, it's a really enjoyable thing to do once you realize, like, I'm okay and I don't have to worry about how I'm perceived in this scenario, right? Like, it takes a lot of pressure off of yourself. So once I stopped feeling like I might be revealed as a fake or whatever, then I didn't have to care about any of that. And, you know, that I think is one of the things that has shifted the kinds of work I've done over the past few years and the people I've gotten to partner with. You're one of them. I love that we get to do this podcast together and also explore all kinds of other schemes together. And there's a few other people who I've collaborated with on different client projects. And they're all people where I feel like I trust them immensely and I know that they trust me. And I don't think I would have gotten to that place if I was still stuck in that sense of like, am I enough? Am I okay all the time?
Yeah, I totally get that. I used to feel so worried about just what everyone else was doing. And I think I had this big fear of being seen and exposed, like you said. And getting over that fear is what has allowed us to collaborate so well, I think. And we wouldn't have been able to see each other's strengths if we continued coming from a place of that comparison instead of paying attention to what like we could add to each other.
Right. Like, we actually don't need to be good at the same things.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we contribute different energies to our partnership, and that is good. I feel really motivated by how driven you are and how productive you are. And like, I love seeing progress happen and things that we're doing. Like, it makes me want to do more. And even though I think I am a little slower at some things than you, I hope that actually slows us down a little bit when we need it in a good way.
I do work myself into a frenzy sometimes. Oh, gosh. Yeah. And slowing down's been hard for me, you know. I had to slow down a bit over the fall after I had knee surgery, and then I had to really like invest in healing, and I found that very frustrating, and I had to think about why I was so frustrated by it. And one of the reasons, I think the biggest reason, was that it made me feel unproductive, and that is like one of the worst feelings for me, not feeling productive. And so I've been thinking about like why that is. And, you know, Heather talks about this in her interview, so I'm excited to dig into it further there. But there's like this very American obsession with productivity. And intellectually, I know that that is bullshit. Like, I make fun of all of those articles that are like 10 things successful people do before 8 a.m. And they're all like, you write 1500 words and then you ran 5 miles and then you meditated and then you had a quality discussion with your children and then you networked over coffee. And I'm just like, when are you getting up to do all these things? Yeah. They're like 12 hours of things. I know all those things are bullshit. I know that they really like fetishize productivity. But I still tend to judge my days, like, was it a good day or was it a bad day, by how much I accomplished. And I still tend to put too much on my to-do list and then, like, beat myself up for not finishing it when it was never finishable in the first place. And so I don't think that's just me. I think that's kind of a cultural problem where I think we really get sold this idea that our value is in our productivity. And that, like, your humanity is equal to your output. And that gets embedded pretty deeply, especially if you're not aware of it, you're not paying attention to it. And so I think something I'm really trying to do this year is start to separate out, okay, I am a person who enjoys activity. I like to do a lot. I like to keep my brain and my body busy. And that's great. I can do a lot. And I can be a person who enjoys that. But I don't need to churn out more and more tasks just because I feel like I'm a bad person if I stop. Like, there's no value in being productive for productivity's sake.
Yeah, it's actually funny that you say that and you feel this way about yourself, because like the other day I had this jam-packed schedule and I was thinking, you know, how am I going to get everything done? Like, I just felt really overwhelmed. And on top of that, I had meetings all afternoon. And then my afternoon cleared up because some meetings got canceled. And I remember texting you, my afternoon meetings got rescheduled, little wins. And you texted back, room to breathe. And I literally took a deep breath in and let it out, just feeling so relieved. So I feel like you do this a lot for me. You help me sort of reset my view on, you know, how productive I need to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot easier for me to say that to you than to say it to myself, right? Like, giving myself room to breathe is much harder. Because I think it's a lot easier to be kind to the people you love than to be kind to yourself.
Yes.
And, you know, that's something actually I think Heather was really good at talking about, too, that, like, as an advice columnist, something she had to do that was hard for her was to learn to take her own advice. And I thought that was a really interesting piece of the conversation, is like how hard it is to deal with your own bullshit, even when you see other people's.
Yes.
I don't know. It was such a fun conversation. Why don't we get into it? Heather, welcome to Strong Feelings.
Hi, thank you for having me on your show. I'm very excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you here. So first up, let's talk about What If This Were Enough? It's a book of essays and I really loved it. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about what that means? Why is that the question you want people to be asking themselves right now?
Well, because we live in a world that tells us that we don't have enough, that we need more, that our feelings of longing for more either can be answered with some product or something to buy or some way of improving ourselves and becoming better. Or they're a reflection, these feelings of longing are a reflection of our personal failings as human beings. In other words, the feeling of longing, the feeling of wanting more is somehow like a moral failure on a personal level. And so my book sort of is this somewhat ambitious attempt to build out a lot of these essays and go somewhere with some of these ideas and think and really kind of investigate and think about how we can fix this bad place we're in.
Why did it feel like something that really needed to happen right now? I think you've talked a little bit about this in the introduction to the book, about sort of like the particular cultural moment we're at and the particular like set of garbage that we've gotten ourselves into.
Well, we've kind of evolved into this strange state. Part of the problem is obviously social media. Everything that existed before in our culture is sort of sped up by social media and thrown in our faces repeatedly by social media, so that we sort of navigate this hyper-aware state of the kind of texture and feeling and the messages of our culture, but we're also alienated from those messages because they're fed to us through the tiny screens we carry around in our pockets, and they're fed to us through our computers. And we also process all of this information in a really personal, isolated way, because it lives in our, you know, in our pants, or it lives in our purses. it's hard to find at this moment some kind of documentation of where we are or a snapshot of where we are that isn't all an extreme close-up on one thing or another. And I really, with this book, was trying to sort of piece together a lot of extreme close-ups into, and a lot of experiences, into a more sort of sweeping and yet relatable understanding of where we are in our culture at this moment and how it hurts us, essentially. And in my book, you know, it'll be something like the 50 Shades of Grey series or foodie culture and, you know, Yelp reviews of restaurants as like an artifact of foodie culture, or the sort of comments by Susan Sarandon after the election of November 2016. And so you zoom in on these small things, you know, to bring it back to that lived experience of navigating within a culture that doesn't necessarily do a good job of connecting with us or connecting us with our own humanity.
Yeah. So I think, you know, one of the essays that I read that I really love that I think was, like you said, very relatable to me was that essay Stuffed, where you talk about Marie Kondo and the decluttering movement and sort of how attractive and popular minimalism has become. And in that essay, you know, what I really loved was the way that you were connecting that also to the kind of constant distraction of alerts and texts and the digital landscape that you were talking about a minute ago too, and how attractive minimalism looks in that context, in that particular moment. But there's kind of this false sense of satisfaction with that because you're very quickly pushed into replacing that minimalism with buying the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. It's like a constant cycle. And so I'm curious, you know, after doing all of this thinking, how do you see us, you know, trying to work ourselves free of that constant cycle of ridding ourselves of our stuff and then replacing it with more stuff?
I honestly feel like every day presents a new kind of challenge as far as keeping the clutter of novelty out of your life, keeping the clutter of too much information, too much news, too many texts, too much stuff in your house. The way that the world works now, there are so many levels of invasive clutter in our lives that it's incredibly hard to just live a very kind of considered, thoughtful existence. It's hard to do the things you love because you're constantly being interrupted. And so I actually think that my new path is extremely regimented, which I, you know, sounds kind of anti-joy, but that's sort of where I'm pointed at the moment. I know how much joy is sparked by going on Twitter, and I have to close it down to 15 minutes a day. And I know how much I love reading, and I have to expand that part of my life to an hour a day, no matter what. I think that I'm kind of standing at the edge of really just allowing myself to be extremely structured in a way that I have always resisted.
To me, it sounds like sort of a sense of vigilance, like you have to vigilantly protect the stuff that's going to allow you to have the joy.
I think the confusion that a lot of us have is if you're vigilant in shutting things out, or if you're vigilant about getting rid of clutter, is that just a form of sort of punitive, self-destructive, self-monitoring? Or are you trying to, you know, get to some best life by, you know, making everything clean and immaculate? And but the path doesn't lead to excellence and bestness, right? It just leads to enjoying the moment and enjoying your day, which is kind of what my whole book is about. I don't know. I feel like you can fight these fights for good in the world and you can be productive, but ultimately you have to remember and understand what feeds you and what makes you happy and what you truly enjoy. It's amazing. Some days I feel like, you know, I go online and all I see are people talking about things that they're buying or consuming, right? And the culture itself protects us from reckoning with ourselves in a serious way. Does that make sense? I mean, I think that one thing that I wanted to just say over and over again was that this is not, you know, the realm of like idealistic hippies anymore. Like we all actually have to really clean up our acts at this moment because we're seeing the results of our high capitalist ways, you know, in very kind of concrete and terrifying ways.
Yeah, you know, that actually brings me to something else I want to talk about. I want to ask a little bit about your work writing advice, because when you mentioned a moment ago reckoning with yourself, I think that that is actually a pretty useful frame for a lot of how I read the advice that you give. It's really asking people to reckon with themselves, which is fucking hard, but that is often, you know, the biggest work to be done. So I know that, you know, like what you do in Ask Polly and the advice that you've written, you don't really do the kind of like practical tips, like my aunt wants me to come to Thanksgiving, but I hate her kind of questions. You do this thing that you've called existential advice, which is like more of the, how do I get my mind right? Or like, how do I come to terms with things? And I'm really curious about that. Like, how did you find that particular voice or that particular angle on advice?
I knew that I was never going to be interested in just giving concrete advice. I don't actually have a lot of good concrete advice to give people about difficult social dilemmas in their lives. But I do think that there are noises in your head and bad voices in your head as an intelligent, complicated woman that become amplified and grow and multiply as you get older. And you can kind of see it once you hit your 40s. You can see the people who have effectively shut down all reckoning and are just like, nope, I don't think about that. And you will ask them questions and they will say to you flat out, it's almost like Ron Swanson on Parks and Recreation. Like, that is not my thing. I would rather fish. You are making it too complicated. You know, why don't you just be more quiet so I don't have to hear you? There was no way I wasn't going to write about just long-winded, complicated, messed up advice that led to, why are we here anyway? You know, what is the meaning of this? It's really strange as a writer to find the thing that you're sort of born to do writing-wise. Yeah, Ask Polly really felt like that for me. And I'm just very lucky that the thing that I was born to do is entertaining and useful to other people, because it could just as easily be, you know, the opposite scenario.
Well, so you say you feel like you were born to do it, but was it ever weird to be the one giving advice or to like feel like you had insight for others?
I still wonder if I have anything to offer advice-wise. I didn't really think that I was some kind of a wise human being when I started down this path at all. I just thought I could write in a free-form way about human problems in ways that would be entertaining and funny, mostly. And now, I mean, I've done it for, I guess, about 6 years. And, I, you know, part of the strange thing about giving advice for a living is that you kind of have to take your own advice and you have to do it well, right? And you also have to ask yourself why you're not happy a lot, which is its own kind of corrosive thing to do. But I think that, I've kind of had to clean up my act and reckon with myself a ton because this is my job. And I've learned a lot from doing that. I hit a kind of a crisis point about 3 years ago where I just had a lot of problems in a lot of my friendship relationships. You know, I have a really solid marriage and it sort of, that had been worked out and my kids are great and a lot of things in my life, my career is great. A lot of things in my life have kind of gone smoothly for the past decade, actually. I mean, really smoothly. But that friendship was like my last frontier. I hadn't figured it out. And instead of just saying, whatever, these people are bullshit, I can't handle them, I should just cut them out of my life, I had to really interrogate what was going on with some of my friendships and new friendships and old friendships. It was like everything started to implode. And I had to look at my attitudes about, you know, about people and about how I look for rejection in minor interactions with people. I mean, I had to look at my shame, which I didn't really even use that word until this process started. And I mean, this wasn't with a therapist. I was just doing this sort of freelance on my own in order to keep doing my job because I kept trying to write my column and thinking, well, you're a mess. Look at the way you're living. You know, look at how bad you are at maintaining friendships. Like, what's wrong with you? And actually, it's been great. I came out of it on the other side of that so much happier. And now I think that process has just been one where I become more and more of an evangelist, you know, for doing this kind of reckoning. I mean, I see the people who do that kind of reckoning and it helps them so much. I mean, my husband's in therapy because I pushed him into therapy because I was like, you know, it's so good, you know, and he was like, I don't want to walk into the darkness, you know, I don't want to know how much darkness is there. And I've just been saying to him, like, go, you know, go straight to the center of everything bad and live there for a while. It's so good because you come out of it, you know, it's like you carry these things around and they're controlling your behavior and you don't even know it. It's such a great process. You feel like a different person if you do this kind of work a lot on yourself. And if you get to the state where you are unafraid, you know, you're just not afraid of what is real and not afraid of reality, which I think is just a central problem that Americans and that all of us in our culture have. It's this feeling that we have to keep reality out of our view or we won't be able to function anymore. I don't know if that makes any sense at all. Just saying that casually, it sounds kind of abstract, but we have this sort of idea that we have to live in fantasy and escape in, you know, we have to be focused on the future at all times. We have to be focused on a better self that's waiting for us in the distance, far away, and that we can't just live in this imperfect moment and soak in everything about it that is good and bad and not okay and okay and wonderful and divine and also just inadequate. That once we lean into that, into the moment, and once we lean into how broken and screwy and, you know, habitually foolish we are, the more we can actually enjoy and savor what we have and really connect with other human beings. Every time I sit down to write my column, I find myself walking toward that message. I mean, it's obvious. It's like, okay, go into therapy is the short way of saying it. But a lot depends on who, the therapist you have and your relationship to what you're doing in therapy. Even if you find a great therapist, your story around seeing a therapist can be, I'm kind of sick, so I have to see this person to help me get less sick. In contrast to the idea that I am discovering what I carry around with me, and it's making me understand how to just accept and be in my life without judgment.
Yes. And like not put that shit onto other people.
Oh yeah. My God. I mean, yeah. The thing is, yeah. And also I was always afraid if I'd lost my edge, you know, if I lost my like rage at myself that I projected onto other people, then I'd just turn into this, you know, saintly, healthy guru type of lady and you know, and I'd just be boring as shit to everybody around me. That doesn't really happen, actually. That's not, I mean, you know, that would be great, actually. You know what I mean? Like, well, the happier you get, the more you're like, hey, that would not be all bad if I were just a bland angel made of light. Like, okay, bring it. That's fine. But that's not how it goes, right? You're still carrying around so much. It's that you're never going to get rid of all of it. I mean, that's part of the message of my book. It's like, what if this were enough? The thing is, the whole picture has an inherent contradiction, right? Because I'm talking about excavating all these things and looking at your darkness, but I'm also talking about dragging that darkness around until you're dead too, because you can't get rid of it. You know, you don't have a choice. You're just, it's wired into your synapses. I mean, I have a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old, and my 9-year-old said to me the other day, I feel guilty because I didn't do anything today. I did nothing productive. And it was like a Saturday, right? And meanwhile, Bill, my husband and I are like, say to the kids all the time, like, enjoy yourself, relax. Like, we are the least overachievement focused parents. And it's so strange because the more you say to kids, like, whatever, maybe you should just skip school today, or who cares what your teacher thinks? Just read a few books today instead and blow off your homework. The more you say things like that, the more kids who are just wired like crazy neurotic beasts like you are say things like, no, that's not even an option. You know, like they just come back at you with their nature. And it's funny, but it's also like, it's actually really hard to coax a human animal into a state of like, just enjoy yourself. Like, just tell me what would make you happy. I think that that's something that, you know, it's a kind of a rare message to give anyone, to remind them that simply, like, should you succeed? Should you be more successful? I don't know. What would that make you happier? Are you sure? These are questions that we don't ask. We just assume that everyone should be more and more and more successful. And, you know, achieve as much as you can and do.
It's so true. I mean, I find it resonating with me a lot. You're touching on a lot of stuff that I wanted to ask about, because in an interview in The Atlantic, you talked about how you tend to stay away from advice like, you got to love yourself, because that doesn't really fix anything if you're, you know, if you're feeling self-hatred or if you're in that low spot. And I feel like part of this is that we get all these messages that we're supposed to be happy, look on the bright side, do a bath bomb and love yourself and, you know, not really talk about our negative emotions or like give them a lot of time. So what's an example of like what you tell people when it comes to actually dealing with those negative feelings like pain and sadness and unease?
Well, what's funny about the do a bath bomb and love yourself advice, I understand that advice a little bit now that I'm happy, but back in the old days, I just encountered that kind of noise as like, who can do this? Like, what is that? What do you mean love yourself? I actually struggle now when I write my column not to skip over the middle part and just go straight to the like, celebrate yourself, you know, because I'm a happy person and I, you know, it seems obvious that that's where you should land. But the middle ground, the middle state, that is a state of, and also, by the way, it's a recurring state. What, you know, I define myself as happy now. I call myself happy and I own my happiness out loud, which is very grating, I'm sure, to many people. But I also, you know, return to a mood of despair regularly. I mean, I'm an extremely moody person and, you know, whatever, your emotions don't just change entirely and now you're clean and pure and made of light and you're happy all the time. So the middle state for me and in welcoming sadness and longing and mourning and loss into your life is it's sort of a combination of allowing it to be and allowing those emotions to sort of have a little time instead of pushing them away. And then also refusing to treat your sadness as a moral failure, I think, is a big, big part of understanding and allowing room for sadness. And so I can't say enough about how important that piece of experiencing sadness is. It was such a dimension of my sadness or anger in the past that my sadness and anger were always accompanied by this voice that said, why are you sad? You are so broken. Why are you angry? You are just an angry person. You are just pathetic to feel anger, which I, you know, maybe that's only a way of processing emotions that is common to someone who was raised by people who often said, I cannot handle your emotional self, please hide it from me. But I do think that, you know, 50 to 60% of parents, just my loose statistics, treat things that way. I mean, I think it's very common. Bill and I, my husband and I, found ourselves doing the same exact thing to our kids that was done to us, even after having a million conversations about how we would welcome our kids' emotions into the picture. We, you know, a really common thing with this, you know, people who grew up in really disordered families is to either overcorrect and say all of your emotions. I mean, you see this among progressive parents often. Every emotion you feel, I want to hear all about it. I have endless time for all your emotions. And wait, your teacher isn't stopping class to hear all of your emotions? What is wrong? Let's go talk to her. Or to say essentially, stop, don't do that, you know. Emotions are, you should be ashamed of them. Go to your room and feel that. Don't feel it around us. You're bringing everyone down, which we found ourselves saying that to our kids. It's really hard not to do. You know, the thing, the irony is when you grow up in a family where that's how you're treated, you actually associate other people's emotions with a really dark, heavy feeling of being your life being out of your own control. The same feeling you had when you grew up in a house that was chaotic and pretty negative and out of your control. So there's a lot of calibrating that needs to be done, right? You have to find some way to get the voices around emotion out of your head and to just experience the emotion for what it is. Sadness is a beautiful thing if you welcome it in and treat it the way an artist treats it, which is to kind of examine it and sit with it and create from it and use it. And see, when you see the world through a sad lens, it's a really beautiful thing. You see new colors and new angles of light, and you experience people in a different way, and you connect to people in a different way, and it's an opportunity. But it's really, really hard to get there until you can say to yourself, I am going to feel sad again. I am someone who feels very sad when I feel sad. You know, I'm going to get mad again, and I'm going to feel out of control again. And that's a very predictable thing in my life. It's the way that I am. And it's not my personal failure that these are things that I experience.
Gosh, I just think that's so important and so hard for people to do when they've built up so many habits around constantly berating themselves for having all of those quote unquote failures.
Yeah, I mean, just keeping the voice from informing everything you do, the negative voice is like the first layer. And then excavating it from emotional experiences, I think, is deeper down. It's like just keeping yourself from, you know, waking up in the morning and saying, "Ugh, I haven't even unloaded the dishwasher yet. God damn it, I'm a failure." You know, like that's the stage one. And then stage two is like, you know, why am I to blame for being a human animal? Why do I turn on myself the second I'm not winning? But once you kick those noises out around your so-called negative emotions and start treating all of your emotions as, you know, these interesting discoveries that have answers within them and that allow you to feel and to see in a more vivid way and to experience the world in a more delightful way, then you suddenly are on this new plane where you're not constantly fighting things off. You're not constantly like, I don't want to have a bad experience. You better stay away from me. You actually have experiences, and sometimes they're a little negative, and you just look at it, you know, and you observe it, and you enjoy the negative aspects of experience sometimes. I mean, if you're really, you know, doing well with it, it's not whatever. It's not like you just forever and ever become this, you know, amazing, you know, spiritual being that can do these things. It takes constant reminding just to do the basics, right? But it also, the more you do it, the more it happens without a lot of thought, right? It becomes your new habit. But I can't think of anything in my life that has changed my life more than the feeling of like, I'm not going to make a moral judgment of myself based on what I experience emotionally, you know? And I'm not going to do that to other people. And I'm going to live in the open and I'm going to cry openly. And people are going to see me do that. And I am not going to be embarrassed by it, even if they're embarrassed by it. And I'm going to be compassionate towards them when they are embarrassed by my emotion.
Gosh, yes. I mean, I personally, I will cry pretty much anywhere and I don't care and I'm not ashamed of it. I didn't always feel that way. I definitely cried in some work bathrooms.
Well, I don't work in an office.
Yeah, so. Neither do I, so it's not a problem anymore.
Yeah. I know. It's easy to brag when you don't have to go into
it. Or sometimes I just have to turn the camera off on my conference call and I'll just be like, it's fine. Mute. Yeah, exactly.
But I do, I really love this push to be able to say, look, you can feel negative feelings, you can have, you know, challenges, you can cry your heart out. And that doesn't necessarily mean anything about you except that you have a negative emotion and you're crying. I love that. And I'm curious if, you know, here we're just about out of time. And I wanted to ask, Our listeners are going to be hearing this just at the beginning of 2019. It's a fresh new year. And there's always a lot of, I don't know, pressure at the beginning of the year about what are you going to change this year and sort of like making resolutions and a lot of stuff that I think, you know, fundamentally people mean well. Obviously, they want to have good changes in their life, but can end up just feeling like even more ways to feel bad about themselves when they don't live up to it. And so at this moment, I'm curious if you have any thoughts about like, how can people start their year with that kind of intention in mind, an intention of not beating themselves up so much?
I think that a very common trap that we a lot of us fall into these days is we really stick with this notion of ourselves as little machines that need to be productive all the time. And the more productive we are, the better we are. And there are just a lot of different aspects of our culture that feed into that message. But that's not how it feels to be happy. Being maximally productive is not going to make me happy at all. Also, the thing about to-do lists is, where is it all leading? You know, it's just leading to enjoyment, theoretically, right? I mean, are you going to be happier once you're 15 times more successful than you are right now? You might be a lot less happy if you never learn to enjoy your day along the way. The point of success is supposed to be to enjoy your life. So are you going to then land at some successful point and start enjoying your life then? And when is that going to happen? Like, are you going to be 50, 55, like nearing retirement? Are you going to work like crazy in your 20s and then in your 30s, you will for sure slow down and enjoy everything? So yeah, I mean, look, if you string together 365 days in this year where you are sure that at least you're going to enjoy your day every day, I guarantee you, you're also going to probably exercise more. You're probably going to cross more things off your list. You're probably going to have better relationships with everyone in your life. And you're going to be happier overall simply because you did that one thing. And you know, but I guess it's also probably important to say, if you're sad all day, does that mean you didn't enjoy your day and you're a failure? I think enjoying your sadness is a worthwhile goal too. Savoring your sadness or leaning into your sadness or, you know, so that's another way of enjoying your day is like taking what is and, you know, savoring it, even if it feels a little bit bad.
I love that. And I have loved listening to you this whole time. Heather, thank you so much for being here. Your voice is exactly what our listeners need heading into 2019. So one last question, where can folks get a little bit more of you in their life?
Well, my book, What If This Were Enough, is essays. I talked about it earlier. You can pick that up at your local library. You can buy it from your local indie bookstore. I am writing a weekly column called Ask Polly that's on The Cut. It's a New York magazine. And I'm on Twitter. It's like at H Haverleski, which is whatever. Try to spell that and it should pop up.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And everyone, pick up What If This Were Enough.
Thank you so much for having me. I really, really enjoyed our conversation.
Lisa Lucas from Best Forevers, a podcast for kindred spirits. I'd like to start a movement where we spend more time loving on our friends because although friends are important to us, they're often in the shadow of other relationships. So if you want to love on your friendships a little bit more, embrace friendship a little bit more, or just appreciate your friendships a little bit more, then this podcast is for you. We'll explore all the different ways friendships take place, share the amazing stories of friendship, and discuss best practices for the difficulties that friends may experience. It's time to embrace friendships because without our friends, who would we be? So check out Best Forevers on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the other podcasting listening venues. And be sure to follow Best Forevers Pod on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
Okay, it is time for a segment I always look forward to, the Fuck Yeah of the Week. I am so excited because I feel like I could use a boost. So, Catel, what is making you say fuck yeah this week?
I am saying fuck yeah to my gratitude journal.
Wait, I didn't know you had a gratitude journal.
Yeah, so I started it this fall when I was starting to feel really burned out, and I've done it nearly every single night since I started it before bed.
Wow.
And yeah, so sometimes I'll fill a page of stuff, sometimes I'll only write a sentence or two, and I don't know, just like something about thinking back on my day, no matter how uneventful or even, you know, bad it might have been or felt, there's always something I find that I'm grateful for. And having this practice, this sort of habit, has really been keeping me, you know, grounded.
Okay, so when you say gratitude journal, I have to admit, the first thing I imagine is like a very Pinteresty post of like a curated desktop with like a really cutesy coffee mug on it, and then this millennial pink journal that says gratitude on the front in like that gold script, like that live, laugh, love font.
Yes.
And I do a little eye roll, which I'm going to admit is totally unfair. First off, if you like the gold script and the millennial pink journal, that's fine. In fact, I do like the color millennial pink. It's fine. I'm a millennial. But I do want you to tell me more about this. Like, what do you do with your gratitude journal? And like, how do you use it?
So I know. I honestly had the same reaction when I first sort of started looking into what they actually were. And I absolutely almost bought one of those millennial pink versions, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it. And so I actually just kind of rolled my own, if you will. I do it with two prompts. I basically just use a plain journal that I have. One prompt is what was good today, and then the other one is what are you excited about tomorrow? And it's just kind of shifted the way I close out a day, and it does something to my brain to kind of reset it. It's also right by my bedside, so when I wake up in the morning, I just kind of like, it reminds me, and I'm like, okay, there are like these things that I said I was going to look forward to, so that's awesome.
What's something you wrote in it recently?
Okay, listeners, this is a little embarrassing, but it's okay. I'm owning it. All right, so this is from early on. What was good today? Went to therapy, ran 5 miles, and walked the dog. It was sunny and hot. I made delicious coffee and a late breakfast. I wrote a little bit and got some work done. Folded all the laundry. And then what I was excited for the next day was I had no meetings.
Okay, no, that's a big excitement.
Very
yeah.
Exciting, yes. That I was going to try to stretch and maybe do a little yoga, and that I was going to try to drink more water and go to bed early. And also, I was really excited because Sarah was coming home from a trip soon.
Aww. I like that I made it into your gratitude journal.
Absolutely. You make a lot of appearances, I will say. So yeah, so sometimes it's literally just, you know, one or two things that I'm just kind of like, oh, great. You know, I actually went out and had really nice coffee today, or I made it out for a run. So
yeah, just celebrating the little things.
Yeah.
Okay, so once I kind of get over my initial snooty reaction to this idea, I love it because it actually reminds me of Heather's advice where she talks about making sure that you enjoy your day. And so I'm thinking more about, well, why is it that when Heather says, make sure you enjoy your day, I'm like, yeah. And then when I hear about a gratitude journal, I'm just like, ew, that's stupid. Like, what is it that makes me bristle? And I think that there are actually two things. Okay, so one, I think sometimes when people start talking a lot about like positivity, what ends up happening isn't just they want to celebrate some good stuff. It's that it's a way to like distance themselves from having to deal with negative things. And sometimes those negative things are like systemic injustices or like avoiding their own anxieties or fears, right? And I really don't want to fall into that trap because I think it's so important to have like uncomfortable conversations with yourself and with your friends and family about the state of the world. And I think it's important to call yourself on your own bullshit, right? Like reckoning, like Heather talked about.
Yeah.
So being grateful doesn't mean like not talking about the stuff that's fucked up. And sometimes I feel like that's what happens is like people will start to be like, no, keep it posy. And I'm like, can't we talk about posy stuff while also acknowledging reality?
Right. Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I very much get that. And I think like, because this isn't supposed to like cancel each other out, but I think that like, there are a lot of places in my life where I'm trying to do that so much more and in a much more present way that I was like, okay, like this is a really little thing that I'm just going to be like, this gives me this little touch point of, you know, some gratitude and some hopefulness and like, and that's okay too.
Yeah. Well, no, and it's essential, right? Like you have to be able to celebrate some of that stuff. And while you need to have hard conversations, like we all need to be having hard conversations, it's like you can't deny yourself like feeling any good feelings ever. Right. That's not going to solve any problems.
Yeah.
Okay. So the other thing that I think often has made me bristle about this stuff is that like it often gets tied into some really like consumerist messages. Mm. Like there's a very large market of what I would call like gratitude merch.
Yes.
And I think that's frustrating because then I think that what ends up happening is that a practice starts getting reduced into just a product and like you cannot buy your way into mindfulness or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so I'm always really hesitant to buy into this stuff because those are the places that my mind immediately goes. And so I want to say fuck yeah to your gratitude journal and fuck yeah to both you and Heather for helping me reframe this stuff and think it through a little bit more carefully and not just throw the whole idea away.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
Fuck yeah to that.
Well, that's it for us this week. Strong Feelings is recorded in Philadelphia and produced by Steph at Edit Audio. Our theme music is Deprogrammed by Blowdryer, which is an awesome Philly-based band. You should check them out at blowdryer.bandcamp.com. Thanks to Heather Havrileski for being our guest today, and thank you for listening. If you liked our show today, don't forget to subscribe and rate us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And hey, get some strong feelings delivered to your inbox. Sign up for our newsletter at strongfeelings.co. See you again next week.
Bye.
Bye.
I've been deprogrammed. I know who I am.